We're talking about stones, the Kensington Rune Stone. Compelling New Evidence is the book. You can link up to Scott Wolter through coasttocoastam.com. Buy this book. You know, there are lots of books that come out with that would make a claim and present a case, make an argument. This is a book that's, first of all, it's as thick as an encyclopedia. It's not a pocketbook, but it's filled with illustrations, photographs, copies. It's the proof. It is the case for the Kensington Runestone from beginning to end. There's a lot here to read. They, if you'll pardon the expression, leave no stone unturned in this investigation, and I think they do it beautifully. We'll get back to just what was written on the runestone, and then who would have been the people that would have been the likely suspects to leave it there, and why there? Why in the middle of this field in a farm in Kensington, Minnesota? It will all make sense next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So, Scott, I'm going to ask you to read what's on the Kensington Runestone one more time. And for people who want to, they can go to the website at coasttocoastam.com and look at the picture of it. But just read again the text that's on the runestone.
Okay. It starts on the face. It says, 8 Goths and 22 Norwegians on this acquisition business far to the west of Vinland. We had camped near two shelters, one day's journey north from this stone. We were fishing one day when we came home, found 10 men red with blood and death, AVM, Latin letters AVM, saved from evils. On the side, it says, there are 10 men by the sea with our ships, 14 days journey from this island, year 1362.
Now, were they on an island when they wrote that?
Great question, and as my understanding is, the word that has been translated to island in Old Swedish could mean a hill or a high spot of land that is either totally surrounded or partly surrounded by water. So,
and that's key here for why we're going to get into why it's left where it was. So
correct.
I just want to make that point.
Yep.
So again, so if we're to guess at the story, what we know is it's as typical of runestones, it marks a significant event, a turning point, whether it means that they're turning back to go to the ships or whether it means that they realize they'll never make it back to the ships or whether it means that with this group that's suffered this traumatic event, does it mean that they think that this is it? This is where they're going to die. And so they're going to mark this spot for people to come later on and find and go, aha, here's what happened to the missing group. We just don't know.
That's right.
Okay. But now we can start making some suppositions about who the they is, because not everybody would have been able to write this language, not even everybody from the island of Gotland in Scandinavia.
That's correct, and I think what's important for people to realize is back in medieval times, certainly in the 1300s, that to have the ability to carve an inscription as complex as this, you really don't have a lot of candidates. In fact, really the only plausible candidates you have would be members of the clergy who would have had the education to be able to carve something like this.
And so who would have been the clergy on the island of Gotland, where this language very specifically that's used on the runestone originated?
Well, great question, and really there's only one answer. At this time on the island of Gotland, the only clergy that was present at that time were members of the Cistercian monastic order, which was a very large, very successful, especially at that time, member that was a monastic order that was affiliated with the Catholic Church.
Okay, and this was a mainstream group, the Cistercians, very well respected, and they had a unique feature to them in terms of how they evangelized.
Well, yeah, they, I guess I'm not sure exactly what you're hinting at, but if you're hinting at what I think you are, we're going to get into an area that is very controversial and very important.
Well, then I'll be more specific. They do something which is some churches do, but they had a very formal way of doing it, When the church grew big enough that they had just planted, then 12 of them would go out from there and start another one.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay.
They would.
So that was their model all the time. They were a very forward thinking group. They were very focused on what we would call today church planting, and they as a part of their monastic worldview is they saw it necessary to keep going out further and further and further from wherever they started.
Yes, and so and if I can read your mind a little bit, I think this is something I've thought about, the idea of going out into the vast wilderness, which of course has been one of the complaints by many scholars. Who would do this? This is in keeping with their tradition. So there's certainly parallels here that you can draw, or the term I like to use is consistencies with their practice and what the things you can draw from the runestone and who may have carved it and why and all that. So yes, there definitely are some consistencies.
And as a monastic order, Cistercians were completely self-sufficient. Every group had to be self-sustaining. Everybody was a craftsman. Everybody was a farmer. Everybody did everything. They were a hard-working group.
No doubt about it. In fact, they were so well organized. It's really an amazing group of people to study, and this is something I've done. And the more I've looked into them, the more amazed I am at how organized they were, at the uniqueness of this particular order. They weren't the only monastic order. There were many monastic orders, but they were far and away the most successful, and they became very wealthy and ended up having much land. They were really incredible, and I think in history, these people and their charismatic leader, Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, are some of the most important historical figures. Certainly, he is, in their order that really is largely unknown by most people. It's kind of surprising.
And they grew rapidly, on the tail end of the Middle Ages in particular, they grew. And it's not the idea, knowing that they're craftsmen, knowing that they were metallurgists, knowing that they were interested in hydraulics, knowing that they were always doing interesting millinery work. They were doing all these that it's not out of the question to think that they might have been, and they would have sailed. We know that they went from Gotland to other parts of Scandinavia. It's not impossible to think that they might have continued to follow previous Viking shipping lines and gone out into the sea and gone to look for new places to build new churches.
Well, definitely, and there's an element here that I think you're leading up to, and that's the Knights Templar, who were a military monastic order that were founded by the Cistercians in 1128. And the charter for the Templars was written by St. Bernard of Clairvaux, which is essentially identical to the charter of the Cistercians. So when you talk about venturing out, now, suddenly, when you introduce the Templars, who were absolutely aligned with the Cistercians, essentially they were one and the same, certainly ideologically, now you have an even more plausible possibility and set of circumstances that could, again, be consistent with, the story we're talking about.
Well, and that let's put that aside for the moment and get back to that, because I think that's really key. But let's just focusing in terms of on the Cistercians themselves, they would have had the education, they had this language, they were from the island, they were on the island of Gotland as well as other places, and it was their inclination to go out and establish new churches and to build new places. Have you ever talked to any of the Cistercians on Gotland? Is there any record of them doing this type of evangelism?
Well, no, I have not talked to any Cistercians on Gotland. I'm not aware that there are any more Cistercians there. The only remnants of that order back in medieval times is the monastery at Roma, and that's in ruins now. And so really the order it does exist, certainly, but nowhere near what it once was, certainly not okay. back in medieval times.
Well, then I wonder whether there has to be, knowing it, as industrious as they are, I wonder whether there might not be a Cistercian historian somewhere that might either keep the record, or on the island of Gotland, where the villages have taken over the monastic records, and whether there is any record of them sending out ships full of, you know, new Cistercian monks, as more and more people were joining the order and it expanded rapidly, whether or not there isn't some record somewhere of them getting provisions, you know, being fitted for a ship and having left at a time that would have brought them perhaps to the New World.
Well, I think you make an excellent point, and I think the answer to that question is I wouldn't be surprised at all. And really what I believe, and I think is really an important point here that you're bringing up, is, you know, if people are ready to put aside some old ideas and embrace this thing and look at it in a logical, systematic, scientific way, there's no question what this is. So if it's genuine, then all of a sudden you have all kinds of possibilities and opportunities for people to go back who have the education, the background to be able to, first of all, read these things and go back and look in the voluminous record that the Cistercians left. And by the way, they had massive scriptoriums. Then and there are who knows how many documents somewhere in there. Probably they haven't even been looked at since they've been written. I wouldn't be shocked at all if there was some evidence or even just a direct record of exactly what you described.
Right. So, all right, now let's bring the Knights Templar back into this. So here we are in the early part of the 14th century, and we know from the historical record that the Knights Templar and the Cistercians are brother organizations. The Knights Templar are falsely accused. They're persecuted. They're disbanded. Their money is sought by kings and princes who are more than happy to break up the Knights Templar so they can lay claim to their treasures. And we know that many of the Knights Templar were killed, but also that many more were allowed to be, quote-unquote, rehabilitated. They spent some time in prison, and then they were released. And others just avoided persecution altogether. Once the word was out that the hammer was coming down on the Templars, a lot of them took what treasure they had or whatever they split. They skedaddled to probably safer ground. It's not out of the question to think that the Knights Templars would come running back to the Cistercian monks on an island like Gotland where they knew they would be safe.
Well, in fact, in the Baltic region, and by the way, there were other orders like the Teutonic Knights that were, just a different Germanic version of the Knights Templar, essentially the same, just a little bit different. But they were would have been the order on Gotland, but they were totally unaffected by this put down order by the Pope and the King of France in 1307. The Templars in the Iberian Peninsula and down into other areas. The major area where the put down was enforced was in France and a little bit in England. So you're talking about a relatively localized area, and the percentage of the total order that was impacted by this put down was probably 10 to maybe 15%. So really, I think there's a misconception about what actually happened and how many of them were affected, but definitely things changed, and they had to make some dramatic alterations, and so the history definitely changed. But to say that the Templars disappeared to history is just simply not true.
So, however it happens, it's easy to see, and there are arguments by Templar historians that the Templars had already. Were already making visits to the New World. They were already looking for a safe place to go. They knew that, you know, that it was unreliable. Their relationship with Rome at that point was unreliable, and that if they really wanted to continue as an organization, they had to find a place to do it where they could live freely. So again, it comes back to a very interesting argument on whether the Knights Templar or the Teutonic Knights traveled with the Cistercian monks. Perhaps the monks traveled with the Templar organization and they head off to the New World. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that's exactly what happened, in my opinion, to be quite frank. And, you know, it's this is where we get into a little bit of choppy waters. But, you know, to me, again, as a forensic person, I look at it logically. And, you know, the fundamental thing I think people forget is that the Cistercians or the Templars certainly were a secret organization, definitely after the put down of 1307. I mean, they were literally being hunted down. And so they formed essentially what you could call a secret society with a completely different modus operandi, and they did everything in secret. And so one of the complaints that many people have about the Templars and some of these theories of coming to North America is, well, where's the record? Well, I guess the counter to that would be, well, I wouldn't expect there to be a record. Because of the circumstances, they did this in secret. And the other important point I think that people really don't fully understand or appreciate is that the New World, these guys were opportunists. They were business people, the Cistercians and the Templars. There's no question about that. And there's many facets to what they were about, but they were definitely business people. And you had this whole vast continent that very few people knew about, and it had a tremendous trove of resources, fur, wood, fish, minerals. And you know, I use the analogy, if you've got a great fishing spot or a great hunting spot, you going to tell anybody about it? So the lack of a record to me makes perfect sense. It doesn't mean that there isn't a record, but the fact that one hasn't been found doesn't prove that it didn't happen. It just proves that you haven't found evidence of it yet. In fact, this stone itself is the record that all that I need, that in fact this theory we're talking about likely is true.
Yeah, it certainly is possible. Have you ever heard of the L'America argument about the Knights Templar?
L'America. No, flesh it out for me.
That's actually where we have the name. This is, again, choppy waters, but interesting nonetheless, that the Knights Templar are the ones that are responsible for the name America. That it comes from a term they used, L'America.
Oh, yes, yes, I have heard of this, yes.
Right, was simply reduced later on to America, but that this was something that they were pursuing. Now, I don't know of any firsthand scholarship that really proves that one way or another, but I always thought it was an interesting idea, and that this became, especially after the persecution started, the idea of escaping with their treasures to L'America, and being free of the European feudal system and being able to establish, you know, societies they wanted to, that they took their ship full of treasures, and that's where they headed.
Yes, I think that's exactly, personally, I think that's exactly what happened. And
well, it's an interesting idea anyway.
Yeah.
So, all right, so now people would be saying, but why Minnesota? Oh, it makes sense to say, okay, they came to, you know, the shores of Massachusetts or Virginia or Georgia or whatever, but why Minnesota?
Well, you know, that's kind of been a burning question, and one of the things I've heard for years from opponents is, well, you know, why would they come to Minnesota? Well, there's a number of reasons why you would come to Minnesota. First of all, at that time, in 1362, the Hanseatic League had a blockade of the Baltic region, and so the supply of furs from the Russian fur trade was cut off. So, you know, one of the archaeologists, anthropologists I've talked to, retired Professor Alice Kehoe, really thinks this was one of the primary motivations, again, the economic one, for why they may have come to this region. I mean, the finest furs in North America are right here. So, and of course, you know, hundreds of years later, we have the French here that took advantage of that opportunity. So could there have been a precedence? Did they follow somebody else here? That seems to be a very strong plausibility and a very likely reason. The second thing I think that's very important, something I've been researching lately, is medieval land claim practices. And if you study some of these, there are precedents where if you could establish as an explorer that you had reached the headwaters of a particular watershed and put down a claim, you would be able to then not only claim the land at the headwaters, but the entire watershed and the land associated with it.
And and so hang on to that thought.
Okay, good.
If you put your land claim At the head of the waters, then you get the headwaters and all that flows from it. That is an established land claim method, and that might explain exactly why the Kensington runestone was put right where it is. We'll talk about the geography of that and the geology of the stone itself, which should prove once and for all that this was real and brought here in 14th century, perhaps by the Knights Templar, next on Coast to Coast AM. So we'll get to your questions and comments coming up in the final hour for Scott Walter. We're talking about the Kensington Runestone, Compelling New Evidence. This book is everything you need to know about it. It's like a compendium about the Kensington Runestone, but really makes a very strong argument for the authenticity of the runestone, and then also the likelihood that the writers of the runestone came from this Scandinavian island known as Gotland that had a unique feature to the language, to the old Swedish. They wrote with a particular kind of, if you will, dialect to their rune. And there's no way that this farmer would have known this, who found this stone in his field back around the turn of the last century. So we know it wasn't, you know, it wasn't him that was playing the hoax. If there was a hoax, it would have had to have been perpetrated by somebody with knowledge of a language that hadn't really come into public discussion until about 60 years later. So there you go. I think that in itself makes the case for the Kensington runestone. But what was on it, we've been talking about. Who wrote it? That's been interesting. We'll talk about why it was placed where it was and a little bit about the geology of the stone itself next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Scott Walter is the geologist and researcher into the Kensington runestone. We've been talking about it all night. If you're just coming in, go back and listen to it on Streamlink. I think you very much enjoyed this show, as well as last night's show, by the way, too. I thought it was great on that little-known nuclear accident that killed three people back in 1961. So why Kensington, Minnesota? Why would it be if the Cistercians, with the help of the Knights Templar or the Teutonic Knights or whomever it was that were they comprised this this manifest that we have in the Kensington runestone of Swedes and Norsemen that are on this journey, why leave this stone in the middle of a field which would later become a farmer's field in Minnesota?
Well, again, we talked about the idea that furs, which would have been a very prized commodity at that time, they could have been looking for an alternate source for furs.
Sure.
That's one very plausible economic reason. The second would be, pardon me?
Why the land claim there? Why make a land claim right there?
Well, that would be one area there to claim that land, obviously for economic reasons. But the traditions that I've been studying of medieval land practices of some countries was if you could prove that you had navigated a waterway to its headwaters and then placed a land claim, you could then make a claim for not just the waterway but the adjacent land, and so all the way including the entire watershed. And in Kensington, you're talking about the headwaters to both in the general region of the Mississippi and the Missouri, the Minnesota rivers, but also the Red River Valley. So if this is true, in theory, you could say that they laid claim to the entire Mississippi watershed and the Red River Hudson Bay watershed, which is an enormous tract of land. So if that's indeed what they were trying to do, that's a heck of a claim.
I think that's very interesting. I really do. I think that makes a lot of sense. Because otherwise, why the middle of a field? Well, that if you look at the larger picture of where that field is, and it's as it explained in your book, it's a farm that's surrounded by water. I mean, there's rivers and lakes all around that area. And so if you're just trying to say this is ours, our blood is in this ground. Look at all the people that died here. We claim this in the name of us.
That's it. Now, There's more to this story, to this land claim theory in this area, which I'm going to be, which I do talk about in a new book I have coming up, and I don't mean to segue off, but, you know, some people are probably saying, well, gee, you got one stone. How do you make that big of a claim? Well, there's more to it than that, but the bottom line is that the runestone really serves as one of the major pillars or most important pieces to this land claim theory that we're looking into.
Okay, I think that explains a lot. By the way, from where the runestone is, where is the 14-day mark? Where is the 14 days from that point back to the sea? Would that be 14 days back to Lake Superior?
Well, that's a great question. It's one of those puzzling things people have pondered. Now, personally, to me, that makes more sense. And what I understand is the word on the stone that we've translated to sea, the word is havet, and it basically means a body of water large enough to create heave on a boat, and certainly Lake Superior would fit that description. Now, some people, a researcher, Helmer Holland, who studied the stone for over 50 years, claims that it was the Red River Valley, and then if you go downstream from the headwaters near Kensington, you end up at Lake Winnipeg. Now, that's a possibility, and then you follow the Nelson River to Hudson Bay. That's a very plausible route as well. Now, can you get there in 14 days? You know, I don't know the answer to that, but some people make the claim that you could have. You could certainly get to Lake Superior. So I think those are the two best candidates, at least in my opinion.
If one were walking, one could walk to Lake Superior in 14 days from where they stood on the farm in Kensington, correct?
I think so, but they probably would have traveled by canoes.
Well, that's fine, but I'm just saying that it could have been any of those. There's lots of different explanations, but many different explanations all making sense on how they relate to where they were to where they were going, either by canoe or by foot or whatever.
Yeah, and to fit in context with the message, sure. I mean, the plausibility is just fine.
So either way you look at it, you've got people coming from Scandinavia following the St. Lawrence Seaway or coming in and making various, you know, diversions along the way, ending up there in that place in Minnesota. So, all right, that makes sense. Now, as a geologist, you've looked at the composition of the Kensington runestone, and you, as going back to where we started in this conversation originally, in your expertise as a forensic investigator, you say this stone is the real deal.
Well, in my mind, it has to be. And you know, I go back to the kind of the way I explain things in my line of work, that these things are all logic problems. And really, if you look at them as logic problems, it makes things a lot easier. And in my mind, you know, you've got two sides to this story. It's either a late 19th century hoax perpetrated by Olaf Ullmann or someone in the community, or it's not. Really, the only other plausible explanation is that it is what it says it is, a 14th century document. So that's kind of the way I approached it. And what I looked at, and if you want me to describe, you know, the geological work I did, I could probably sum it up pretty quick.
Yeah, let's do that, just because that's your expertise. Give us a minute or two.
Okay, sure. Well, we did a number of things, and one of the things that we do in our business before we can even begin to start the work is we have to know what we're starting with. And to do that, we need to take invasive samples. And in the case of the Kensington runestone, I took a small core sample, an inch diameter by 2 inches long, core sample out of the back of the stone, and we made thin sections, and we identified what the rock was. And I was fortunate enough to be able to do this with one of my former professors from University of Minnesota Duluth, Dick Ojikangas, and I really appreciate his help. But we identified the rock as a Precambrian-aged metagraywacke. And what that is a sandstone that's been cooked and heated geologically over millions of years. What was nice about that is that it created, it's got a lot of different minerals in it, some that weather quickly, some that weather slowly, and it gave me a lot of minerals to choose from to try to figure out what the weathering of the inscription was. And of course, the question that everybody wanted to know from me was not how old the stone is. Of course, the stone is very old, but how old is the inscription? And incidentally, I think a very important point here that we need to say right from the get-go is that Dick and I concluded, Dick Ojukangas and I concluded, that this stone is indigenous to Minnesota, probably came from the Anamiki Basin, which is up near the Cuyuna Iron Range in Minnesota. And so it's consistent with glacial flow lines that this rock was likely carried from that area into the Kensington area, and the Kensington party that carved it found this rock, split it down to the final shape that we see, and carved the inscription. So that's just some basic information, but that's important because a lot of people have asked me, well, could they have brought the stone with them from Scandinavia? And the answer is no.
No, and there wouldn't have been any purpose for it, probably.
Well, it would have been a big job. Why do that when it would have been easier just to take a local stone?
And this thing weighs a couple hundred pounds.
Yes.
Okay.
So you
wouldn't be throwing in your canoe and portaging it either. I mean, this is the kind of thing you find it and you carve on it, and that's much more in the tradition of the way a lot of the runes are anyway. It's you carve what's there and making it serve your purpose instead of bringing one with you like you would stationary.
It just doesn't make sense to do it the other way. It makes sense to use local material. I agree with that.
Okay, so we can establish that geologically it's there. Linguistically, we now know that it was written in a very specific dialect that only goes back to one particular place in Scandinavia in these runes. So what is it? How does this change the way we look at history? What are we rethinking if everything we've said is true?
Well, I think it's really not a small point at all. It's a huge point. And what it means is that the established history that we have been told, I know you and I are probably similar in age, and Columbus discovered America, and that's what everybody was taught. Now, Lonsa Meadows, which is a Norse Viking settlement area up in Canada along the eastern coastline there, changed that premise forever, and I think sometimes people forget that, but I really think that it opens the door to a whole new interpretation of history prior to Christopher Columbus. Now, it's not the subject of the discussion tonight, but I will tell you that there are hundreds of artifacts and sites in this continent, pre-Columbian sites, that need to be studied. Now, when I say pre-Columbian, they appear to be pre-Columbian. What they are at this point is unknown. But the way they've been treated by modern scholars, historians, archaeologists, in my opinion, is reprehensible, to be quite honest. And as a scientist, I look at these things and I say, okay, they need to be studied. Because if there's any chance that they could possibly be what we think they are, pre-Columbian artifacts, it's vitally important to the history of this country. This artifact alone changes the paradigm in a profound way. And I guess it boils down to this, Ian, is that if standard academics were wrong about the Kensington Runestone, what else were they wrong about?
Right. I think most people are good with the idea that Columbus wasn't the first Westerner, that there's lots of evidence about all the different groups that have come here and touched North America other than the Native Americans that were here. I think this stone makes a much stronger argument than for some of these other things that you speak of, like the famous carving of a knight in New England that seemed to imply that knights had been here and that other things had happened, that it's like, okay, well, the more that these things pop up, the more we have to say these trade winds were blowing here with many more ships a lot earlier than anybody really was willing to say before, and in such a volume. And this is another example that they would have probably been following along somebody else's map that says here, go here.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, that they weren't necessarily the first ones either, just because they left the earliest evidence.
Well, isn't that interesting how when you delve into things like this, that you find somebody did something, but most often the case is they followed somebody before them. And all I know is that I just want to know what happened. I think Americans and people in general, are able to handle the truth. There were political reasons for why something like the Kensington Runestone would not have been convenient to be legitimate, especially when we were first laying out our country and claiming land. To have somebody else coming here would not have been politically expedient. So there, it's a complicated story, but I think the time is perfect now to come out with the truth, and let's examine it. And it is what it is. We can handle it.
And I think it's interesting. I mean, this is sort of a Minnesota thing, but, you know, here on this stone where it specifies essentially Swedes and Norwegians working together to do this, which... It may be the last time Swedes and Norwegians work together on anything in Minnesota, but the level of cooperation, the interest, I think it's fascinating, and I think that there may still be pieces then out there. For example, if we can find Cistercian shipping records, whether there is where they have a record of a ship having come back about this time from a long journey, and whether there's anything that they brought back with them that would have been helpful to the Cistercian monks, you know, or did they send out other, if the Kensington runestone's true, then, and I believe it is, then what other runes might they find in Canada or other places where the Cistercians might have also been traveling that previous to this hadn't gotten consideration?
Well, stay tuned, Ian, because there are plenty of artifacts. There are other runestones. There are structures. And these are some of the things that, and I don't want to be a shameless plugger here, but I
plug away. That's the next
book coming out that discusses all of this.
Okay. And this would establish then a larger and more frequent visits from this group.
No question about it.
Okay. These are stones that had existed and also not been able to be translated before the discovery of this old runic language?
Yes. Again, these things were confusing to modern scholars, and again, you know, the same problems they had with the Kensington runestone. But I can say this, there are five runestones found in North America that are clearly connected, one of those being the Kensington runestone, is unquestionably that link them to the same group of people we've been talking about. And this really becomes the focal point of this new research that I've been doing. And I'll tell you what, I mean, all kidding aside, it is just amazing. It's incredible. And I think that the evidence from multiple disciplines, including history, language, geology, is consistent with the premise that we're talking about tonight. So
yep. I think
fascinating story.
I think it is. I think one of the reasons why I'd heard it dismissed, too, the Kensington rune story, is because of this mistake, and you alluded to it. Of people thinking that, well, here are all these Swedes and Norwegians, and they want to pretend that Vikings had been here before. It was part of their folklore. Yeah. But again, if we're talking about the 14th century, we're not talking about Vikings. Right?
Exactly. I mean, and the term Viking implies that they were pagans or non-Christians, and that you know, carries a lot of things with it. This is Christian times. There's no question about it, and the evidence is on the stone. Once you understand and realize what these people were about, how their minds worked, or how you think their minds worked, once you look at it in that context, you see a whole set of different things, which clearly indicates that it's a Christian document, no question about it.
That's fascinating. And I guess I would we'd have to change the name of the team to the Minnesota Cistercians.
No, the Minnesota Templars.
Well, that'd be cool. I think that would be cool. But and the Templar connection is interesting. And I think that's we start going down a road that, while I really love, it's compelling to think that the Templars were involved on any of the rune stones that you have found. Is there any specific reference to the Templars on any of the other runes that you've come across?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and really it's a complicated discussion, but it's on the runestone and it's on these other stones that clearly suggest, and I think the word that we probably want to use moving forward, Ian, is Templarism.
Okay. A Templar-like.
Well, Templarism, which refers to a mindset or a philosophy, and that's probably more accurate, I guess.
Okay.
But Templars is okay, too, I guess.
All right. Well, that's just where we'll leave it until you jump in the conversation. Now the phones are already ringing. We'll give you the numbers that you need for your question, your comment, to Scott Walter, the forensic geologist and the co-author of The Kensington Runestone, Compelling New Evidence. We'll get to your questions and comments coming up next. Go online, take a look at the pictures, you get a better idea of what we're talking about at coasttocoastam.com. This is Ian Potter.